From CAFE, welcome to CAFE Insider. I'm Preet Bharara.
And I'm Ann Milgram.
Hi, Ann. How are you?
I'm good. How you doing?
So before we get to all the stuff we need to talk about, I have a public service announcement. We have a live Zoom event for folks with noted historians Heather Cox Richardson, who has been a guest on the Stay Tuned show, and Joanne Freeman this Thursday, March 11th, 6 p.m. It's free. Sign up at cafe.com/live. That's cafe.com/live. So we're recording this on the morning of March 9th. And before we started taping, you know, we chit-chat a little bit before we hit the record button, kind of to loosen up, right? See how each other are doing.
And actually eat our breakfast also, if we're honest.
Don't tell them everything, Ann. The healthy breakfast of champions that we both have as we begin to tape. And, you know, it was a year ago when really the world changed. I mean, it started to change before a year ago, but I think I mentioned this before. You were prescient enough that in the beginning of March of last year, you talked to the team about getting us our own mics at home because you realized maybe we wouldn't be going to the studio anymore. And you were very right. What I remember about March 9th and March 8th, you know, it was the 8th, the Sunday, when you kind of knew bad things were happening and you were seeing what was happening in Europe, but it didn't quite hit home yet. And for me, it was the Sunday evening when my kids, my boys, high school, just shut down abruptly because someone tested positive for COVID-19. And then on the 9th, I went to teach my seminar at NYU Law School. And that was the last time I was in that building. So a lot of things changed a year ago.
Yeah. I mean, I remember, in some ways, I remember it like it was yesterday. And in other ways, the past year is just a blur. But I remember you and I did a photo shoot to do the cover art for CAFE Insider. And I think that was, and at that point we were giving each other elbow greetings, but like that was really one of the last professional things I think I did, that and the podcast that week. And we'd started talking
it was like a week earlier
about,
right?
Yeah, about how to get sort of to go remote. But I think watching Europe and Washington State, I had a sense that something was coming. But I have to say, truthfully, I don't think any of us knew what was coming or what the year would bring. And I feel, you know, it's been a really heartbreaking and difficult year. I also feel really grateful, you know, to you, to the Insider team, to our listeners, to, you know, family and friends that have, people have been amazing in the past year. And now people are getting vaccinated, which is just a really positive. It's an extraordinary thing that we're here a year later. It's been such a hard year, but it's also amazing where we've gotten.
Yeah, a lot of people aren't here. Can I say one frivolous thing? With respect to that photo shoot, I think it's lovely. I think we both look okay. But there have been a couple of mean people who said it looks like a photo for an ad for personal injury lawyers, Preet Bharara.
Yes, 1-800, call
we have, you know, good
call
fans.
Auto insurance.
Yeah, if you've been harmed, Ann Milgram and Preet Bharara can help you. No, it's been a very tough year. And, you know, when you say this thing about how it was hard to expect how bad it would be. And there were some models that were predicting. Ian Bremmer, who's been on the show, posted a prediction that was from a year ago from some outfit that predicted potentially 400,000 deaths and higher. But, you know, my guest on Stay Tuned this week is a very prominent, noted, super smart physician, Atul Gawande. And, you know, he has training. And he said, sort of confessed, that a year ago, it didn't occur to him in a deep way that it could get this bad. But we see the light at the end of the tunnel, I hope. I mean, you know, did you see yesterday that there are more people who have been vaccinated than there are cases of COVID at the moment?
It really is amazing. And we have a lot of friends in New York who are helping people get appointments, seniors, vulnerable people. It's really an amazing and inspiring thing to sort of see what's happening. Can I say one thing about Atul Gawande? He's written one of my favorite books of the last, you know, 5 years that I've read, which was Being Mortal.
Complications?
No, Being Mortal. Yeah. Have you read that? I mean, it's.
I read Complications. It was actually a model for my book, as I mentioned to him.
Yeah, yeah. I'm really looking forward to listening to that podcast.
So, Being Mortal. What about it?
It's a really important and beautiful book. It's about half of it is sort of about what's happening with long-term care and nursing homes, which we're about to talk about today in the context of Governor Cuomo, and the other half is about his personal experience with his father, who was ill with cancer and passed away, and just sort of navigating it and sort of how to think about these end-of-life conversations and how to sort of, you know, do this, do what is a natural part of humanity, right? Living and dying. How do you do it in the best way possible for the person and for the family? And I read it for a variety of reasons. It was recommended to me just by a bunch of folks. It's just an amazing book, but it really is. I would really recommend it to everyone.
Good. So by the way, as we are speaking, I have the TV on in the background on mute on C-SPAN 2. And the reason I think you have the TV on to C-SPAN, tuned to C-SPAN 2, is that our good friends, brilliant lawyers and leaders, Lisa Monaco and Vinita Gupta, who I think listeners know pretty well, they've been on the show a bunch of times, and Lisa had a podcast with us, are having their confirmation hearing for Deputy Attorney General and Associate Attorney General, respectively. And so I wish them luck. I hope and expect they will get confirmed, and it will make a big difference at the department.
Yeah, I'm excited to tune in after we're done.
All right. That's all you have to say about that.
I have a lot. What I really want to say is that I wish I could be watching that instead of our podcast.
Talking to me?
Just because I really
Thanks.
Want to watch it. But you know,
Thanks,
it's okay.
Anne.
It's okay. You can't always do everything. I'll catch the highlights later. But yes,
well,
I'm
recording it on the DVR. I'll let you watch it after I do. So you mentioned Anne, Governor Cuomo, multiple investigations swirling around him. With respect to the sexual misconduct, sexual harassment allegations, we have been waiting for the Attorney General of New York, Letitia James, to make an outside appointment pursuant to something called a 63B referral. The Attorney General, with the consent of the governor, which has been given, she has the authority to appoint an outside independent lawyer or lawyers to look at something that's in the public interest, to make a review, to issue a report, and make other recommendations, etc. So after a number of days, she has made that appointment. And it's interesting because one of the people I know very well, she has appointed Ann Clark, who is a lawyer who for a long time has been involved in representing people. And she's been a longtime lawyer in the area of sexual harassment and sexual misconduct and employment law. And the other person is my dear, dear friend, June Kim, who was the deputy U.S. attorney when I was in office and became the acting U.S. attorney in the Southern District of New York when I got fired. I've known him for 20 years. He's brilliant. He's hardworking. He's completely ethical. He has a lot of integrity. And so I have a lot of confidence that he will do a great job. I don't know Ann, but I hear good things about Ann Clark as well. And the other thing that June knows is, you know, he was in the top leadership at SDNY when we were investigating, and people forget this, when we were investigating the governor himself and people around him. And June oversaw the ultimate conviction of Joe Prococo, who was basically Andrew Cuomo's top aide for a variety of public corruption crimes. So he's familiar with how to do high-profile investigations. He's familiar in particular with some of the ways that Andrew Cuomo and his lawyers deal with things. So I think it's a perfect choice.
What's interesting to me is that you would expect this to be a senior female lawyer. And I do a lot of sort of internal investigations into sexual harassment. And I often work with companies that basically say, look, we'd like to have a female lead, in part because it is really important to have a senior woman as part of the team, as what they've done here is bring Ann Clark in, who's very experienced in this space, because, you know, the idea being you want women to be totally comfortable. And here are the complainants, the women who have come forward saying that they were sexually harassed by Governor Cuomo, they are women. And so this sort of idea that there's a level of comfort, whether that's fair or not, or whether that's a question of perception, I think, you know, we could discuss. But there are actually a lot of really amazing, significant female lawyers who've held positions of authority in government over the past 5 years. And so I thought June was he's tremendous. I don't know him like you know, but I know him by reputation. I've met him a couple times, and in some ways I think it couldn't have happened to a nicer guy, right? It's going to be a lot of work, and it's going to be real. I mean, this is going to be a tough assignment in some ways. But part of me actually thinks that the reason he was selected in something where you would expect a little bit, maybe that they would have gone in a different direction, is that he's investigated Cuomo and Cuomo's folks, and he has experience in dealing with this. And I think that that's probably not an insignificant calculation in a city and state where Andrew Cuomo has been governor. He's in his third term. He's extraordinarily powerful. You're looking for someone who's not going to be afraid to, you know, call balls and strikes on him. And June already has a track record of having done that. And so that to me sort of explains a little bit. And again, I think he's an exceptional lawyer. I don't know if he's done this kind of work, but again, Ann Clark really has. And so as a team, I think they'll make a great team.
Yeah. So I think it's a good marriage. you know, I don't know. This is all speculation. I think Tish James was trying to send a message in addition to appointing people who could do the work. And the message is that, you know, one of the leaders of the investigation is fearless and not afraid of Andrew Cuomo and all sorts of things that he may try or stunts that his lawyers may try, because he's been known to do that kind of thing. And also to make sure that people understand that this person is in no way in the tank for Andrew Cuomo. Remember, at the beginning, Cuomo tried to pick the person who was going to investigate him. And he initially picked someone with a great reputation, Barbara Jones. But Barbara Jones looked like she had some connection to someone who was very close to the governor, Steve Cohen, at the law firm. Then he tried to get someone who also owes him her job, Janet DeFiore, the chief judge of the Court of Appeals in New York, to be the one to pick the outside person. So I think to contravene any suspicions that the person would not be fully independent, she picked someone like June to go along with Ann Clark to show this person doesn't owe Andrew Cuomo anything and has been strong with respect to the governor's office before. And we'll see how that goes.
I think she's also sending another message, because June is the former acting U.S. attorney, right? And so, you know, you expect people will cooperate with investigations, but there are times where people don't cooperate. And if there were, you know, obstruction or other things to happen, like, you're basically sending a message that you're sending in someone who is experienced in criminal prosecutions. They have a very strong background. June will know how to wield the subpoena power to get documents and evidence. And so in the end, I think that this is going to have turned out to have been a very good choice with the two of them. And I have no question as to their independence. And I my gut is that you're right. But it did, at first, I had to sort of step back and think, well, it wasn't exactly what I would have expected.
Can we talk for a minute about the investigation itself?
Yes.
You've done these kinds of things, and I've been thinking about what are the sorts of steps that you would take. Would you immediately interview the identified victims who have come forward? Would you immediately subpoena the governor's office and any other entity that might have in their possession written complaints, former complaints? Would you ask for the emails right away? What's the order in which you might do this?
I mean, I think the answer is yes. And to all of the above.
You do everything because, at once, right?
Yeah. Well, part of the challenge, and just so folks understand with internal investigations, is that you need to get all that internal information. Here, you'll probably have people who had government-issued cell phones, or, you know, it used to be BlackBerries, but now they're probably iPhones or Android devices. You'll want access to those. You'll want access to all the emails that were sent. You'll want access to all the logs of who was in the governor's office. You'll also want to see the hiring and sort of staffing. Who worked in, you know, the governor's office can often be a number of people, but there's a small inner staff that's made up of executive assistants, like one of these women, and sort of, you know, folks who would come in contact with the governor's office a lot. You're going to want to understand on the days and times that the women say they were in a certain place with Governor Cuomo, who else was there? Do the records show, confirm that they were there? So that takes time to get those documents. So basically, day one, they're going to start asking for all of that stuff. And simultaneously, they're going to set up times to talk with these women. And also, you know, there's sort of a few pieces here. One is, are there other complainants? Are there other individuals who may have been, whether they themselves were the subject of potential behavior or they witnessed potential behavior? And also, there's a big question here, Preet, like in every investigation of, well, who else did you tell, right? Or did anyone ever mention to you, like when you came into the governor's office, did anyone ever say to you, like, don't be try not to work late at night by yourself or anything like that? And again, that's totally a hypothetical from other matters I've handled. We don't know what the facts are going to be here. But in a situation like this over time, and we now have five women who've made allegations, four of whom worked with the governor. The fifth was at a wedding, and I would sort of, you know, put that to the side at the beginning of the investigation, because sexual harassment really involves harming women's ability to work. And so that would really be the focus here, are the women who were at work. I'll tell you what else I would look at something like this, Preet, and I'd be curious to hear you on this. The response by the governor's office. So some of the questions will be, of all the women who have made complaints, and if any new women who might come forward, did they say anything to the governor's staff? Did they make formal or informal complaints? Who did they go to? And what did the governor's office leadership do about it? And so there's at least one instance where we know that one of the women made a complaint to one of the governor's senior staff members and then ultimately told another one and then was transferred to another office. That's a very old school thing to have done.
But I think the question is going to be a couple of questions. One is, did they follow protocol? And the second is, with respect to all these things that the governor has been saying, Is he truthful? Is he credible? Because at the end of the day, part of the consequence here is going to be political. June and Anne are going to provide a report. Presumably that becomes public. And they're not just going to examine the allegations and the underlying conduct, but also the response, as you say, by the governor. And there are a couple of things where I think the governor may already be in trouble. One of those is his immediate response in connection with his apology has been to say, I had no idea that I offended anyone, that I made anyone uncomfortable. And I got to say, even without seeing the results of any exhaustive investigation, that seems to be a bunch of BS. Because with respect to at least one case, if this is corroborated, as you just pointed out, this woman went to the staff. She was transferred. She's someone who had been known to the governor. Is there any universe in which Andrew Cuomo, who is a severe micromanager and knows what's going on in his office, would not have been told that something was up and that something strange had happened? I can't imagine. And the second thing, just quickly, and this may be a minor point, I'm curious what you think about it, is he was asked the question, you know, did you take the same sexual harassment training as every other state employee has to take? And he said,
short answer is yes.
And then there are also reports that say that, you know, he had a staffer take that training for him. And that's not the biggest thing in the world, but the more his credibility gets beaten up in a final report, the worse it is for him. Do you agree?
Yeah. So if just to break down a few things, I mean, first, you're right. The question will be, did they follow protocol, which is dictated by sexual harassment law? So this is going to be the question of, you know, did they do what is legally required to be done? And as a rule in sexual harassment, we don't let people just, you know, complain and then walk away. We don't give them the option. And it seems heavy-handed when you talk about it. But the idea is, like, just take Charlotte Bennett. She's 25 years old. She's an executive assistant. The governor is, like, you know, 20 levels senior to her, as you said, right? And so there's just this huge disparity in power. And so if you ask someone like that, you know, would they want to proceed with a formal investigation? The answer is almost always going to be no, because of that power imbalance. And so I think it is a really important question of, did they do this by the book or did they not do it by the book? My instinct, I see issues here, right? And that would be something I would spend a lot of time understanding. In terms of what he would have known and said, I mean, this is a moment where she's one of his executive assistants. And so he's going to see her frequently when he's in the office. And so let's say, hypothetically, that there's a situation where no one tells him anything, which I personally find very hard to believe. It's implausible to think he wouldn't have asked, hey, where did she go? Why did she leave? Right? Like, yes. She was a good employee. Like, why did she disappear overnight?
He's the most serious micromanager of any public official that I am aware of by reputation, and I know this from personal experience with him as well.
And on training, I think you're right that it is a big issue. And I think it's a big issue. Look, you and I we take the sexual harassment training for NYU. It's long. It's online. You have to watch videos. There are hypotheticals that are very specific as to what you can and cannot do. It would be clear from if it were similar to the NYU training, and I would guess that the state training is very serious as well because they take this seriously.
It might be identical. I mean, I think these trainings are vetted and probably have some degree of consistency.
And a lot of the hypotheticals will be similar to some of the things that we're hearing, some of the allegations we're hearing here. So one thing that's also fascinating is it's not a whodunit, right? I mean, these women have said Governor Cuomo did this, and he's basically said, yeah, I did a lot of it, but I never intended to cause the harm. So he's denied sort of the physical, you know, the unwanted kissing, but he hasn't denied the other things. And so that puts us in this, you know, you already have some admissions. And then the question is going to be some of these pieces around, you know, is he credible in saying that he had no idea people didn't like it and no one ever said anything to him? I think when it comes time to things like the training, what training he did, conversations he will have had with staff or others, he's going to get pushed really hard on that. And I think your instincts are going to be right.
A couple other things I want to say, and I know that some people in the country who are listening have only just come to know Andrew Cuomo in the last number of months, and they enjoyed his statements and his press conferences about COVID, and he appeared to be a strong leader. You know, Andrew Cuomo has been around for a long time, and I have a lot of experience with him directly because we investigated various things. There was, I don't want to belabor the point and go over ancient history, but there was an anti-corruption commission, the Moreland Commission, that was stood up because of the work of my office, because we were arresting, prosecuting, and convicting legislator after legislator in New York, both Democrats and Republicans. The governor felt he had to do something about it because he's responsive and realizes it didn't look good that the governor wasn't taking public corruption seriously. So he sets up this Moreland Commission, and then he disbands it under weird circumstances, in my view, prematurely. So we exchanged, you know, I exchanged words in public. And I will just say that among the challenges of investigating powerful people is if those powerful people wield their power or are known to wield their power in a particular way, meaning they make clear that there will be hell to pay if you cross him. And there are various reports, just even in the last number of weeks, where the governor has called up another politician and said, I will ruin your reputation. This is the kind of thing he does. I remember being kind of taken aback when we were having, you know, sort of public disagreement about the closing of the Moreland Commission. Multiple people wrote to me, including one journalist, with some concern and said, you know that the governor engages in retaliation. And I'm like, I don't know what kind of retaliation he's going to engage in against me. I'm the sitting United States attorney. And people joked, you know, do you have an armored vehicle? Do you have bodyguards? And those were jokes, but they were jokes that arose from a perception, not imagined, but real, that this is a person who doesn't like anyone to cross him. So that's a dynamic, I hate to say, that's at play here as well. Notwithstanding how jovial he may have seemed in some of these press conferences that he did, which also, by the way, have been undermined by this other issue, the undercounting of people who died in nursing homes as well. So Andrew Cuomo did not arrive anew in the country as his benevolent hero. He has a long history of doing certain kinds of things and acting a certain kind of way and averting his eyes to certain kinds of things in the state for a long time. And, you know, if we say those kinds of things about Republicans, we have to say those things about Democrats too.
I want to talk about the healthcare piece, because I personally think that this is also really important. And one of the things we're seeing here, which is unusual, is that a lot of times when you and I talk about an issue or an investigation, Preet, it's one thing. And here, there's two very significant investigations ongoing, and they're both important. They're different, but they're both really important, and they do go to core questions of credibility and leadership and integrity in government. But the healthcare thing, and we should just, you and I have talked a little bit about it, the allegation made by the state AG that Governor Cuomo's office, the health department, and the Cuomo administration were undercounting the number of nursing home deaths because they were only counting for the purposes of a July report that they released, and then they did not provide information that they were requested to provide by the state legislature until a judge ordered them in February. They did not disclose that the number of people who were living in assisted care, long-term facilities, nursing homes, who then got sick and then were transferred to the hospital and passed away at the hospital. So they only counted people who'd passed away in the nursing homes and not people who had been living in nursing homes or long-term facilities and then transferred to the hospital. And that's inconsistent with how other states did it. The majority of other states, I'm not sure whether any other states did what New York did, but most of them basically counted everybody. And what just came out over the course of the past week is that there was a point in time in July where the health department, the state health department, sent a draft report to the governor's office, which is not uncommon, right? A lot of times, like, you know, you're going to issue a big report on something that's obviously the number one priority for the state, COVID, and the pandemic. So you're going to have the governor's office be aware of it and look at it. And often governor's offices will make some suggestions on maybe language or policy, but here they did something different. They took out those numbers. So they kept in the numbers of the individuals who'd passed away in nursing homes, and they took out the number of people who they believed had died after having been transferred out of the nursing home. And this, to me, I wanted to sort of get your gut on it, but this to me is, it's really significant for a number of reasons, but it's sort of evidence of, like, you know, that was there, and they actually, you know, doctors, healthcare professionals prepare those reports. The governor's office is a political place, and the political folks took out that data. So what's your read on that?
Well, I think it's very serious. I don't know if it constitutes the crime of obstruction or making a false statement, but again, I don't think that's the standard for elected officials. And it's particularly egregious in a way, given two things. One, this is around the time he was thinking about writing a book and getting clearance from ethics officials to write a book that was going to be sort of a mission accomplished victory lap, even though still hundreds of thousands of people were at risk and continued to die from COVID-19. And then the second thing is, he was doing this, and again, it needs to be corroborated and investigated fully, but if the allegations bear out, this was a time when Andrew Cuomo himself, at those press conferences, was chiding the president of the United States for not following the science, for not paying attention to the experts, for ignoring the doctors. And if you believe the reporting with respect to this nursing home issue, you know, Andrew Cuomo's staff, whether at his direction or with the understanding that Andrew Cuomo would have liked this, were doing precisely that. The reporting is that many health officials, some of whom I think left office, but many health officials were upset and were disputing the way that the governor's office wanted to count these numbers. So it's hard to sort of stomach someone who's criticizing the leader of the country for doing all sorts of things that were upsetting the doctors and the professionals and the experts when the leader of the state was doing some of those same things behind the scenes. So, you know, there are a lot of other things happening as we speak. And the jury selection in one of the most significant trials in a long time, and certainly of its kind, is happening right now in Hennepin County, Minnesota. And that's the trial of Derek Chauvin, who, as everyone will remember, last May was seen on video essentially killing George Floyd, a Black American, Derek Chauvin, a white officer. He and three other officers were charged with felonies. Derek Chauvin is going to trial alone. The other three officers are going to trial later. And the judge, as might be expected in a case like this, maybe people don't fully appreciate the difficulty of jury selection in a high-profile case, he's allotted something like 3 weeks to pick 12 jurors and 4 alternates who can be fair and fair-minded in connection with this trial.
So one of the things we've seen is jury selection was supposed to start yesterday, and it was put over, because the judge, the trial judge, dismissed last fall the third-degree murder charge, which is essentially the depraved indifference charge. And that charge basically went to that Chauvin had basically, you know, caused the death of George Floyd. But the underlying law, there was a question as to whether you had to be presenting a harm to others. And in the course of that, someone died.
Let's just take a step back for a second. People should understand that Derek Chauvin was charged with murder in the second degree and murder in the third degree, but the judge threw out the third degree murder. Now, and that seems odd to folks potentially, right? Why do you throw out the lesser charge, not the higher charge? It usually doesn't work that way. Well, to prove murder in the second degree under Minnesota statute, you have to show that someone has caused the death of a human being with, quote, intent to effect the death of that person or another, but without premeditation. That means in the moment, your intent was to cause the death. Murder in the third degree under Minnesota statute says, whoever without intent to effect the death of any person causes the death of another by perpetrating an act eminently dangerous to others and evincing a depraved mind without regard for human life is guilty of murder in the third degree. And so with respect to that issue of an act eminently dangerous to others, and what do you make of that?
Well, and this has been back and forth, right? So Judge Cahill, who's the trial judge, he dismissed the third-degree murder charge last October, basically agreeing with Chauvin's defense team, who basically said no one else was put at risk other than George Floyd. So arguing the law actually requires that there be others at risk, that it can't just be one individual at risk. In the
not
meantime,
just one other. I mean, so that
not
language.
Not just one other. So, yes.
So their lawyers are arguing that you have to take that word very seriously, and the plural is the plural. And in this case, I guess, the only person who was in harm was George Floyd. Yes, okay.
That's right. But in this case, the Court of Appeals in Minnesota upheld third-degree murder charges against another former police officer, Mohammed Noor, who had shot and killed a woman while on duty. And that was basically a similar situation. Noor argued that his actions were directed at the victim alone. There were no others at risk. And the court basically found that Noor could be held accountable, and he was convicted, and they upheld that conviction under third-degree murder. So the judge here in the Derek Chauvin case, basically who had dismissed that third-degree murder count, the appellate court has now said to this judge, you need to consider that third-degree murder charge in light of our ruling in the Mohammed Noor case. And this happens frequently, where there could be a statute that isn't used often. It gets used. It goes to a higher court. The higher court makes a finding and then basically says to the judge, look, your read of the law is inaccurate. We're telling you what the right reading of the law is. And I take it to mean that the third-degree charge will be added here. But that's something where the judge agreed to put off the jury selection for a day or two. But what's interesting about this, so there's a second-degree murder charge, there's a question about a third-degree murder charge, and there's a manslaughter charge. One of the reasons why I think that the judge is very much moving to do jury selection even before this issue is resolved as to third-degree murder, I think that's a mistake. And I'm curious to hear what you think, because in state court and in Minneapolis, the lawyers will get to ask questions of the jurors, and the judge often reads what the charges are. I mean, it's often a part of this, this selection of the jury that the jury gets to, you know, sort of understand the nature of the charges against the defendant.
Yeah, you have to frame the charges that are actually going to be the ones that the trial is going to try to prove. So I agree with you. I think you should have squared away before the process of voir dire happens. And maybe that will be the case, but you need to square away what the particular charges are. In my experience, and I don't have a lot of experience in state court, but in federal court, the jurors are made to understand the nature of the charges, the basics of the facts, so the determination can be made about whether or not they can be fair, not knowing every single fact. Obviously, that's the purpose of the trial, but knowing the basics and not knowing whether or not a particular charge is going to be in or not, and have that, you know, come in later, I think undermines the sort of seamlessness of the jury process. And it might also be confusing to folks. Why is it that the prosecutors are fighting so hard to get a lesser charge into the case, back into the case? Usually you're fighting to get the higher charge. That's the thing you see on television a lot. And the reason is, I suspect, that the second degree murder charge is a harder one to prove. As we, you know, referenced earlier, you need to show intent to affect the death. And it could be that some jurors will find, depending on how the facts come out at trial, Derek Chauvin did a terrible thing and he wasn't quite intending for the death, but boy, he had a depraved mind. He didn't have regard for the human life of George Floyd, and the conduct may better fit in the minds of some jurors, murder in the third degree. And so you want the jurors to have that option.
What do you think also? I mean, I've been thinking about the 3 weeks. I think it totally makes sense. I actually feel like this is going to be a really hard case to pick a jury in. First of all, there's been an incredible national, international media exposure, right? I mean, I would be surprised if you found anyone. And the prospective jurors have already done a written questionnaire, even before they'll walk into the courtroom to be questioned. And it's possible that some of the folks, the defense and prosecution
well,
can agree
I just to- saw, and I just saw that before we started taping, based on the written questionnaires, as of this morning, Tuesday morning, 16 jurors were already dismissed.
Exactly. And so there are going to be a number of others that both the prosecution and defense will just agree outright to excuse. And there are a variety of reasons why that could be the case. It could even be, you know, as simple as somebody saying, look, I come from a family of police officers and I wouldn't feel right about this, right? And everyone would agree, obviously, they're not going to be able to be fair and put aside their personal experience to judge the facts and the evidence. I also, though, think, Preet, I was thinking about this a little bit also, in the context even of the Roger Stone case, which seems a little bit far afield, but remember a number of those jurors spoke out after the trial, and remember that there was an attack, I believe, on the jury foreperson who had had some tweets related to Donald Trump, and there were sort of allegations of bias. And so as I was thinking about this, I was thinking about how critically important it is going to be to get people who will really and truly be able to evaluate the evidence and be fair and not walk in with a bias, and to really understand and make sure that people are being forthright about that. There are a number of people who will want to be selected for this jury. I mean, that's just the way that's the way that these things often go. Because they want to do their civic duty, because they feel strongly about it. But I actually think that this is going to be a huge amount of responsibility on the prosecution team as well as the defense team to make sure that everybody who gets on there is fair and unbiased and can listen to the evidence.
It's a kind of a funny thing, because no matter how famous or how much attention a particular event has gotten, there are always going to be people in America in some community who just did not pay a lot of attention to it. So in the case of a famous celebrity being murdered and people wonder, are you going to get a fair jury because there's been a lot of news about it? There are some people who just don't watch the news. And those are the kinds of people often who end up serving on the jury. Now, in this case, I've heard defense counsel allude to this. It's not just some celebrity. This was a killing that has a significant impact on how we think about rule of law and order in this country and policing in this country. And so ordinarily, you would say, well, maybe there are a few people in Hennepin County who didn't pay attention, didn't care about the case, and they will come with no bias and will have an open mind. But the defense lawyers are saying such people as that, in their words, I think, don't meet the standard of civic engagement that you would want for jurors to sit on a case like this. You know, what kind of person was so incurious or so not caring as to not know a thing about the killing of George Floyd almost by definition, I think the defense lawyers have been suggesting publicly, such people are not fit to serve on the jury. I thought that's kind of an interesting twist on this idea of having people who have no knowledge of the facts serve. What do you think?
It's really interesting because I also think you're right that there could be some people who, you know, don't read newspapers, don't listen to news. But this is something where this is being tried in the city where this happened. And I would find it very hard to believe that even if somebody didn't read the news or a newspaper, that they weren't told by somebody else, that they didn't have some awareness. And again, they may not know George Floyd's name. They may not know Derek Chauvin's name. But the idea that they would have zero awareness, it feels to me almost impossible.
It's not credible, you're saying.
Yeah,
right?
And exactly.
And you would find such a juror to be a red, you would find that to be a red flag just in terms of credibility, you're saying.
I would ask a lot of questions. And when I was in the Manhattan DA's office, and sometimes, you know, I'm a consultant, a technical advisor to Law and Order, and every once in a while they do jury selection. And I love it when they do that because it is really fascinating to watch a state or local jury selection proceeding where the lawyers are able to ask questions of the prospective jurors. And you really are, you're raising the central themes of the case. You're not asking directly about this defendant with this victim, you're saying, you know, do you understand that intent can be formed in an instant? So you could leave your house intending to go to school and then decide, oh, I want to go into the coffee shop before I go to school. And you've formed an intent to go into the coffee shop. So even if you didn't leave thinking that you were going to do something, you ended up doing it anyway. And that might be the kind of thing that becomes really important where someone goes out and there's evidence that they've planned a robbery, and in the middle of it, they end up stealing a car, right? And so you're trying to prove the intent that they stole a car. It's just, these are the kinds of things that you do to just get the jury thinking in these ways. And also, it's frequently very helpful, for example, if you have circumstantial evidence where you don't have direct evidence of a crime. And so again, you're figuring out and sort of talking to the jury about some of the themes that they're going to see. And here it's going to be really interesting. So I think we're going to know before the trial starts what Derek Chauvin's defense will be, because we're going to know it through his lawyers who are going to ask the jury questions about, you know, whatever that defense or those themes might be. So I think it's really important. I think even 3 weeks might not be enough. And the prosecutors need to be vigilant here too. They need to protect a potential conviction. And so that's something, you know, you think about with high profile cases, and you know this, but you want to make sure that everything is done by the book, because you don't want an appellate court to look back later and say something was done wrong, so we're reversing the case for a new trial. And so they're going to be really careful.
You make a good point. I don't know if they're probably, because you're a consultant, they do a better job of this on Law and Order, but you see all the time. And I saw a show recently where the judge is bending over backwards in favor of the prosecution, and the prosecution doesn't do anything or say anything. In real life, good prosecutors would disabuse the judge of the notion that they had to do that thing, because it doesn't help you to win at the trial level and to lose on appeal. And so good prosecutors, unlike what you might see on television sometimes, make sure not to take advantage of a judge who's maybe going beyond what he or she should do to help the prosecutors, because that's just going to hurt on appeal.
100%. I'm with you.
So one more thing, Anne, that I've mentioned on Stay Tuned, and I think people are hearing about in the news, but you and I have not talked about it, and it's very upsetting for a lot of reasons, but also because I happen to be Asian American. There has been this really terrible rise in hate crimes against Asian Americans all over the country in the last year, but particularly against older Asian Americans. The FBI, you know, defines a hate crime as a, quote, criminal offense against a person or property motivated in whole or in part by an offender's bias against a race, religion, disability, sexual orientation, ethnicity, gender, or gender identity. And then various states have hate crimes laws, including New York, that include national origin. And the numbers are just shocking. There's one organization that has documented 2,808 incidents of anti-Asian discrimination from March to December of 2020, and some people, and I agree with these people, think that it's in part related to how people have made, you know, a racial or ethnic issue out of COVID-19.
I would say, you know, even the 2,800 incidents that have been documented, there are probably many more. And so I think it is alarming. I think it is something everyone needs to be paying attention to, including local law enforcement. And to get a sense of the scope of how horrifically bad I think this has become, in terms of hate crimes, the NYPD has formed an Asian hate crimes task force. I mean, that for the NYPD, they already have a hate crimes group. They, you know, groups of folks that do civil rights crimes and hate crimes. For them to form a specific Asian hate crimes task force is a sign to me that they're seeing a real uptick and a real problem. And I agree with you on the language. I mean, Donald Trump frequently did refer to coronavirus and to say really negative things, both about China and use what I would consider to be ethnic slurs in describing coronavirus. And I think words matter. And here, the choice of those words and the use of those words has engendered a feeling of blame. And as my six-year-old would say, like, if you want to blame anyone, blame the pangolin and the bat, right? Like, it's like, you know, he once asked us, like, who do you blame for coronavirus? And we were having this whole conversation about we don't know exactly how it transferred from an animal likely to a human. And so he sort of, I think, is on the lookout for pangolin. Lens and bats. But look, this is not the first coronavirus to transfer from animals to people. And the idea that you would blame any one specific group of people or country is just, I mean, it's just deeply, deeply problematic. And by the way, that doesn't mean you can't be critical of the response and argue that the Chinese government should have alerted the World Health Organization earlier. There was sort of a lack of transparency at the beginning and at a time when it could have been critical for greater transparency. So I think you can both wish that things had happened differently and you know, believe that there should be a certain amount of accountability. But also, this is a totally different question. And I think it's really important just for you and I to acknowledge that what we're seeing nationally, it's deeply disturbing. And, you know, I think that a lot of cases will be prosecuted as hate crimes over the course of the next year.
Yeah, we'll have to monitor. So by the way, folks who have listened to the show for a long time know that there are certain things that we talk about, certain interests that we have, chief among them, Anne has a penchant for penguins. So anytime, which I love about our listeners, anytime there's something interesting having to do with a penguin, Anthony Fauci is wearing a penguin mask, for example.
I have a penguin mask.
Send letters. You do?
I do.
Well, I haven't seen you in a very long time, so I wouldn't know that. But when stuff comes up relating to penguins, people tweet at me and Anne or send letters or notes or emails. And we saw a tweet from Twitter user at Alexander Bobin.
Before I get to Alexander Bobin, can I say one thing, which is that some of our great listeners over the holidays had apparently sent me a small gift that had gone to NYU, and it somehow must have kicked around the NYU mail system, which is like Byzantine. So we only recently got it, and I opened it up, and I was actually going to send you a message saying, "Did you get like it was a really thoughtful gift of dryer balls, like tennis balls that you can put in your dryer?" And I sort of thought, "Oh, I didn't know I needed them," but then I of course I use them. I use them when I wash my son's jacket, and I thought they're amazing.
What does it have to do with penguins?
Wait! But when I first got them, I was like, "Oh, I didn't know I needed them, but maybe I do." And I didn't think anything of it. I put them down. The next week, I had to wash my son's coat, and I opened them up, and I screamed. Do you know why? You know what they are? They're what? Penguins.
They're actual
they're
penguins.
They're penguin dryer balls. Yeah, I'll have to take a picture and send them to you, but they're phenomenal, and I love them so much. And so thank you to our listeners. It took 3 months for them to get to me, or 2 months for them to get to me, but they got to me. So Alexander Bobin writes, at Ann Milgram, a woman finds a penguin at her doorstep. Her friends tell her to take it to the zoo. Later, they see her walking down the street, still carrying the penguin. They ask, "Weren't you going to take it to the zoo?" And she replies, "I did. Now I'm taking it to the movies." I still like, laugh every time I laugh.
It's so dumb. And yet,
it's so good. Thank you, Alexander. By the way, what was with me not using a penguin hypothetical today? I used a robbery.
Yeah, I don't know.
Used a robbery hypo.
I think maybe you knew we were going to read this tweet at the end. If I told that joke at the dinner table, my kids would get up and leave.
They would say it was a dad joke and groan.
It was a dad joke, yeah.
It's so good. Thank you.
So the Chauvin trial, we'll see how that goes. We'll see what goes on with the Cuomo investigation. I'm sure there'll be other news as well. Also, just a reminder, tune in for our live show on Zoom this Thursday, 6 p.m. Eastern, cafe.com/live with Heather Cox Richardson and Joanne Freeman. And I'll talk to you next week.
I'll talk to you soon.
That's it for this week's Cafe Insider podcast. Your hosts are Preet Bharara and Anne Milgram. The executive producer is Tamara Sepper. The senior producer is Adam Waller. The technical director is David Tatasciore. And the CAFE team is Matthew Billy, David Curlander, Sam Ozer-Staten, Noah Azulai, Nat Wiener, Jake Kaplan, Jennifer Korn, Jeff Eisenman, Chris Boylan, Sean Walsh, and Margot Maley. Our music is by Andrew Dost. Thank you for being a part of the CAFE Insider community.